any year, given away more than $2.3 billion. You can compare that with the excess of U.S. merchandise exports over imports to and from developing countries, defined as all countries excluding Canada, Australia, New Zealand, Western Europe, Japan, and the countries of the behind the iron or bamboo curtains, in South Africa too. And that runs around $2 billion every year, except, well, even during Marshall Plan years, because that was going to work in Europe. So what it comes to is we've been giving away, since World War II, about $2 billion a year in effective things designed to aid development. Well, how does that compare with our income? If you take a look at our net national product, which is the measure of the goods and services that we produce annually after deducting what we need to replenish our store of capital equipment, net national product has gone from about $200 billion in 1946 to $785 billion in 1968, which means that, well, we were doing pretty well, say, in 1949, which was the Marshall Plan peak, because then we were giving away something like 2% of our income. But that was only 1 year. It immediately dropped down to a little over 1%. And right now, we're coasting along at about 0.25% per year. So foreign aid is not breaking us. All right, next issue is kind of related. There's a myth that says that our balance of payments situation will not allow the United States to give any more foreign aid. This is a very complicated question, and I'm going to handle it cavalierly. But the balance of payments, I wish every American would think on this, meditate on it, and even if he doesn't know what it means, believe it. The balance of payments is an accounting construct. That means it's something that accountants make up. Now, they make it up because it serves a useful purpose, but it is still made up. And like all accounting concepts, it contains arbitrary elements. The balance of payments always balances. It's made up so that it does. Now, when people complain that the balance of payments is in deficit, what they really mean is that the balance of payments is balancing because some things are not the way we want them to be. For example, we don't want to lose gold. So when the balance of payments balances by gold flowing out of the country, people say the balance of payments is in deficit. Some people don't want us to have any restrictions on imports, like protective tariffs, or no currency exchange restrictions, or no import equalization taxes, or any of that sort of stuff. And so they say that when we have these things, then the balance of payments is not in balance. In other words, it depends on what you like and don't like, what you want to do and don't want to do. Which means that if we want to give more foreign aid, we can do it. But if it does not enjoy a higher priority than a whole raft of other things, like if it means more to us not to allow foreigners to build up large balances of U.S. dollars, if that means more to us than giving foreign aid, then probably we can't give more foreign aid. But it is a matter of priorities. It is not true that the balance of payments prevents us from doing anything. The balance of payments only prevents us from doing certain things if there are a raft of other things that we also want to do and want to do more urgently. And I'll just mention one other thing that we seem determined to do, or two things. We seem determined not to increase the price of gold. If we did that, we could give lots more foreign aid without anything else changing the balance of payments. We also seem determined not to allow the dollar to be devalued relative to other currencies. Whether these things are wise or unwise, I don't know. But if we felt that foreign aid was of high priority, we could go ahead and give more foreign aid. Obviously, we don't.
Excuse me, Bob, mm-hmm. Who's this accountant who sets up this balance?
Well,
is it national or is it international?
It's called the U.S. International Balance of Payments. There are standard procedures that all of the Western industrialized countries use. although they do vary, because the techniques of measurement vary from country to country. But it's pretty well standardized in the Western world. And quite simple, too. Can be explained relatively easily. But it's in balance for the same reason that assets always equal liabilities plus net worth. Because assets always equal liabilities plus net worth, because if assets don't equal liabilities, the difference is called net worth. Again, the reason, in case some of you puzzle, I don't know, maybe it's early in the morning, but if the United States were to just if we were to import from the rest of the world $30 billion worth of goodies, Scotch, tartans, Volkswagens and all that, and export absolutely nothing to the rest of the world, well, you'd say, gee, we'd have a $30 billion deficit. No, we wouldn't. Because we couldn't do that unless the foreigners loaned us $30 billion, right? And so we would have, in effect, imported $30 billion worth of their IOUs. And that would be the balance. That balances it up. If there's smuggling, that's taken care of in statistical discrepancies. All right, third myth. Foreign aid has been money down the drain. Some people make this statement across the board. There's a guy named Eugene Castle, who is the head of a film company, Castle Films or something. He's for a long time, I don't know, he may be dead now, but he used to write a lot of little books and pamphlets on the foreign aid program, claiming that every dollar we'd ever given had gone down the rat hole, or else it had helped a commie come to power or something. And he wrote a book, it was called Billions, Blunders, and Baloney. You used to run across this statement sometime, but it's not true. The Marshall Plan was foreign aid, and I think the Marshall Plan was a great success. At least it accomplished its objectives. Our objective with the Marshall Plan was to enable Europe to recover from the devastation of World War II, to become economically strong, and, kicker on the end, remain impervious to the blandishments of communism. Well, I think we succeeded. Very few people will say that the Marshall Plan was a failure. Well, that leads to myth number four. Since the Marshall Plan was such a big success, that proves that if we spend enough money, we will be able to secure economic development everywhere. And that is not true. The truth of the matter is, of course, that Western Europe is not like Asia, Africa, or Latin America. And I don't care how devastated the economies of Western Europe were after World War II, they had some things going for them that the countries of Asia, Africa, and Latin America do not have going for them. One of them is the economic literacy of their people. That's terribly important. I know there's a great deal of interest today among economists in something they call human capital, an investment in human capital. It's probably the biggest single research area at the current time in economics. And the data are really fantastic. As economists attempt by a variety of statistical techniques to sort out the contributions to production of machinery and natural resources and human skills, or skills embodied in human beings, which is what we mean by human capital, the contribution of human capital emerges as overwhelming time and time again, which might say something here about our domestic problem of ghetto schools. We are spending so little, and what we spend is so ineffective in the ghettos. Is it any wonder that these people then do not make large contributions to the economy when they grow older? All right, myth number five, and now I'm going to get into the ones that will make you mad. The United States, I'll put it in ringing tones, the United States has a moral obligation to make huge development grants to the underdeveloped country. I call this a myth because the concept of a moral obligation on the part of a government seems to me to be utterly without meaning. I know we use the phrase all the time. We talk about moral and immoral acts by our government. People around here talk about the Vietnam War as an immoral war, and I think that is utterly without meaning. I happen to think that the government has made a serious mistake in getting deeply involved in Vietnam. But I call it evil because all war is evil. But more than that, I call it stupid. And that's debatable.
But the notion that a government can engage in moral or immoral acts, I find it utterly without meaning. I don't know what it means. It seems to me that the concept of moral obligation can never be applied to a collectivity, like a labor union or a corporation. It seems to me a moral obligation, when we think about what we mean by moral obligation, it is something that only individuals can assume, that only individuals can feel. I mean, the President of the United States, he has moral obligations to his wife, to his children, to his office. He has a moral obligation to his office. And through that office to all of us, he does. But what is that moral obligation? It seems to me it's the obligation to do for all of us the best he can as he sees it. In other words, to promote the national interest. And if he gets it into his head that the United States has some sort of moral obligations and runs around trying to secure these or to assume these moral obligations, I think he, well, first place, I don't think he does. But anyone who believes that the United States constructs foreign policy on the basis of moral obligations is, I think, seriously deluded. You cannot write a history of foreign policy on the basis of moral obligations. You will find overwhelmingly that the touchstone of foreign policy for the United States, the Soviet Union, and every place else is national interest. And not only is that the way it is, I think that's the way it should be. I believe that collectivities should serve the interests of those who create, support, and control them. Otherwise, the collectivity should be abolished. I don't want collectivities controlling men, but I want men controlling collectivities. Well, come to myth number 6. It is in the national interest of the United States to support economic development in the underdeveloped countries. I don't see why it is. We often hear it say, well, poor people, people who are starving, are likely to go communist. Seems that people who are starving are not likely to go communist. If you oppress people severely enough, they tend to accept whatever they have. The best way to start a revolution seems to be to encourage a little development. The most revolutionary countries are the developing countries. Now, if we are against revolution, if it is in the national interest of the United States to prevent and forestall revolutions around the world, it would probably be wise not to give any foreign aid. Also, charity does not win friends, especially among nations. Some Americans are so terribly hurt because we've given all this money to those people and they don't love us. When did any nation ever love another nation because it gave it money? When do people love people because they're the beneficiaries of charity? You hate that. Other nations look at the money we give them and they say, they are so filthy rich that they can give us these crumbs and not even feel it. And they are rich because they're exploiting us, obviously. And they ought to be giving us a lot more. And it's not really a gift, it's something they owe us. And when rights come to right, by golly, we'll take it away from them. But you know, we give them money and we tell them, now you be grateful, you slob. And they hate us. I want to balance this. It does seem to me that a world of desperately poor people mixed in with a few incredibly rich people like us in Western Europe, Canada, Australia, New Zealand, such a world seems to me to be of doubtful long-run stability. But how long is the long run? Well, I suspect it's beyond my lifetime. That's a prediction made on the basis of the assessment of relative power. I just doubt that these... I'm being hard-nosed now. I doubt that the desperately poor and starving peoples of the world can, within my lifetime, I'm assuming everything goes on much the way it is now. They continue to exist with high rates of infant mortality or
not high rates of infant mortality, which leads to rapidly expanding populations so that they die in some other fashion in their infancy, maybe more miserably. But let's assume the present misery throughout 82% of the world continues, and the nations of the West continue to get richer and richer, and the gap between the rich nations and the poor nations expands. I say this is a situation that seems to me to be of doubtful long-run stability. But I do not believe that the poor nations would, within my lifetime, accumulate enough power to upset the apple cart, particularly now that the Soviet Union has seen that its interest clearly lies in alliance with the United States. And I expect to see a continuation of the trend, which is being pushed, accentuated by the Maoist Soviet split, the trend of the Soviet Union to see its interests as essentially in harmony with those of the United States. Rich people, and the Soviet Union has gotten there, sort of, have a way of discovering that they have much in common with other rich people. And people who live in rich houses with lots of glass do not throw stones. It is interesting that the leading Soviet physicist, Andrei Sakharov, in his recent book, Progress, Coexistence, and Intellectual Freedom, has talked about the danger and the irresponsibility of fomenting revolution around the world. but if it is true that in the long run, you know, things can't go on this way, and besides, it makes us terribly uncomfortable to think of all of those people in India and Pakistan and Africa and so on who are starving, or at least miserable, when we have so much. Maybe, people say, maybe it is in our interest to answer generously the poor nation's plea for aid. And I want to spend the rest of the time examining this thesis. When we come down from the clouds of moral rhetoric into the real world, we never find, quote, poor nations asking for aid. What we do find is particular persons asking for aid, usually particular governments. And this has implications that we must be very, very aware of. First of all, when our government responds favorably to another government's plea for help, that is intervention. And that's not a trivial point when most of these governments have an organized opposition. I mean, how would we feel, you know, if Nixon is running against, whom can I safely say in this select company, who's safe, huh? Well, no, there's some who wouldn't. Well, I don't care. Muskie. Let's say Nixon's running against Muskie in 72, and you are a gung-ho Democrat and supporter of Muskie, and Nixon is having some problems. Let's say the country is experiencing inflation, like it presently is, and we've got real problems down there in the slums. A lot of people are discontented. We've had to cut the level of welfare payments, and we've cut the farm subsidies because of the budget pinch, and you know, the inability to balance the budget anyway is what's causing the inflation. So a lot of people are very unhappy. And 6 months before the election, the German government, or the Russian government, offers to give us $3 billion to solve our problems. How would you feel as a supporter of Muskie? I mean, you'd feel that was intervention, wouldn't you, in American domestic affairs? Maybe the example is too silly even for us to understand, to appreciate, but it makes a heck of a lot of difference in these countries. When the U.S. comes along and gives aid to a country, it is strongly supporting and shoring up a government which is probably otherwise of doubtful stability. So, that raises the question. To which governments do we respond favorably? Do we then buttress all governments? Or just good governments? And what's a good government? Is a good government one that supports our foreign policy? Or is it a government that's capitalistic? And if it's a capitalistic one, does it have to be capitalistic in rhetoric? or capitalistic in fact? Or is a good government one that is democratic and free? Or free but not democratic? Or democratic but not free? Mm-hmm. How democratic? How free? How pro the United States? When we examine these questions and answer them, we are deeply involved in intervention. Now, moreover, many governments are corrupt. There are many governments of the underdeveloped countries where the governors prefer the maintenance of their own power to the economic development of the country. So, do we attach strings to our aid? You see, here's a guy, what he wants to do is stay in power. The U.S. is willing to grant him $500 million. He knows that for the development of his country, that ought to go for a hydroelectric project that will also enable him to irrigate huge sections of the country and use some of these marvelous new hybrids. But he also knows that that won't pay off for 5 or 6 years. And he's in trouble right now. But what will pay off, maybe, is a Colosseum and chariot races. So, do we tell him, we'll give you $500 million, but we'll tell you how you can use it? Well, the trouble is, you know, he can probably justify, the government can probably justify almost any project, not the chariot races, maybe, but maybe he can even talk about the morale of the people and creating a spirit of love of country and willingness to work and, you know, all work and no play makes Johnny a dull boy. I mean, but if we get down to the question, who is to judge? If the United States grants aid, but it wants it used responsibly, we're going to have to involve ourselves and watch all the time. And we're going to have to answer questions like, is a textile mill better because it gives people clothing, or is it worse because it buys political popularity at the cost of establishing the necessary industrial foundation? Or is a steel mill better because it does contribute toward establishing this industrial foundation? Or is it worse because a steel mill is really a status symbol or a military asset? We are deeply involved in intervention when we give aid and try to make sure that it's used responsibly. And of course, we don't want it used irresponsibly. That's why when we give welfare to all the ladies who have no husbands to support their children, the aged, that's why we have social workers peeking through the window to make sure that they don't use it badly. But suppose we say, all right, what we'll do is we'll restrict all our grants. The trouble is, when you restrict your grants, you can't really restrict them. There's an interesting thing the federal government is doing now. You know, it gives money. It gives money to church-supported colleges. We preserve the solemn principle, the Christian principle, you know, that the Baptists have foisted upon us, of separation of church and state by saying, well, but this money cannot be used for religious buildings. And that's silly. The university had $1 million, which it was going to have to use to build a new lab for the physics because they had no lab. The government comes along and gives them $1 million to build that lab. So they use the $1 million now to build a new chapel. In order to prevent this sort of thing, the government has to put people in the management of the university to make sure that, to understand the whole decision-making process and to make sure that a government dollar that comes in doesn't free another dollar to do something that the government doesn't want done. Suppose we say, all right, now, you people, we're going to give you money, but don't you buy any rifles and go out and shoot your neighbors. Well, we're going to have American agents planted all through that government to be sure that, you know, unless we tell them, thou shalt not buy any rifles. But, you know, as soon as we do that, that's a deep form of intervention. And moreover, that means that we are going to have to be responsible for the national security of the country to which we are giving aid. You ever heard that story before? Well, foreign aid involves us in intervention. And the more serious we are that the foreign aid do some good, the more deeply we become involved in intervention in other countries' affairs. Maybe it would be worthwhile for us also to remember that economic development is not the be-all and end-all for the peoples of the underdeveloped countries that we sometimes pretend. I mean, why in the world don't they have flush toilets like we have? There are so many instances. You can think of Sukarno in Indonesia, who threw away Indonesia's prospects for economic development and did it to the screaming cheers of, I think, most of his people because he was going to conquer West Irian,
and that's more important. West Erie is utterly useless to Indonesia, but by golly, it would be another opportunity to thump the Dutch. Look at the Arab nations. If you gave them a choice between pushing Israel into the sea on the one hand and remaining poor, or on the other hand, letting Israel remain and becoming rich, which would they choose? Or Khrushchev, famous interview that Alek Nov had with Khrushchev, where he told Khrushchev, he said, look, you admit that your big problem is agriculture. Now, look, you've had your private plots, which are about 1% of the total arable land, produce something like 50% of your meat, poultry, eggs. Why don't you go this route? For 30 years, you've been mucking around in agriculture, and you can't grow enough food to feed your people. Here's a system that works. And Khrushchev said, some things are economically correct, but not politically correct. So economic development is not be-all and end-all. And if we want countries to be single-minded about economic development, once again, we're going to have to get deeply involved in their affairs. We're going to have to tell them what customs they... Well, let's go into India and tell the Indians, you can't worship those cows. You have to make them into hamburger. Well, what about, I've been talking about government aid. What about private aid? What about private foreign investment? It would seem that this might minimize intervention. Because if a U.S. corporation invests abroad, it has relatively little power to influence the decisions of that government, or at least it has less power than our State Department has. Moreover, when American corporations invest abroad, typically they bring along a very complementary resource, technical and managerial skills. They don't just send their capital over there, they send their technicians and their managers along. And I think that private foreign investment has done a good deal for in those places where it has really been had some size. It has done a good deal toward the development of these countries. However, it hasn't done much because there hasn't been much of it. The private investment tends to be about balanced by private withdrawals. And of course, American firms want to invest where their investment is secure. And most of these underdeveloped countries do not have good records when it comes to political stability. You don't want to invest $60 million in a project if you fear that within 6 months there's going to be a coup d'etat and the new government will confiscate all that investment. So substantial private investment seems to presuppose security in the country where the investment is taking place, and this seems inevitably to mean ringing up the consul, and the consul rings up the desk in Washington, and the United States does get involved. The United States does bring pressure to bear on foreign governments in order to protect private American investment. I believe that one of the reasons for, I think, our rather tragic split with Cuba was the over-eagerness of the American government to defend the investments of American firms in Cuba. Now, I think a government does have an obligation to try to secure the interests of its citizens when they invest abroad, but I think that the government has to do this very, very carefully and realize that there are certain costs that just shouldn't be borne. Maybe one we should say, make it clear, well, when you invest abroad, you're taking a huge risk. Or if we feel that American citizens should not have their property confiscated, that the American government has an obligation to protect their property, then we should say, well, there's a cost to getting involved there, and there's a cost to compensating these people. And it might be better for us simply to compensate our citizens who lost property abroad out of general taxation. It might be cheaper than to go messing around in that other country and try to keep it from doing something that it's determined to do. Foreign investment went ahead very rapidly in the days of gunboat diplomacy. But because it was so firmly supported by the gunboats, it tended to be investment in those projects which were not necessarily of benefit to the country or to the balanced and comprehensive development of the country. It was possible for the foreign investors to go into those areas which promised the highest returns in terms of a country that was tied by trade to the mother country. And this isn't the kind of investment that these countries are looking for today. Many of the underdeveloped countries are very eager to secure American, private American capital, but they want it put where they want it put. And our investors are not eager to do that unless there are gunboats riding at anchor in the harbor. Well, moreover, I'll leave this point, any kind of private foreign investment probably presupposes a capitalistic environment, whatever that means, you know. But one of the things that seems to mean, among other things, is a non-revolutionary environment. And yet many people insist, and I suspect they're right, that social revolution, which is very hard to disentangle from political revolution, this is a prerequisite of economic development in most of Asia, Africa, and Latin America. And that means that, you follow all these steps down, that if we try to take steps which will get more private American capital flowing into the underdeveloped countries, we may at the same time find ourselves sitting on those revolutionary forces within the country which alone are capable of creating an environment that would eventually lead to comprehensive economic development. That's a long sentence. But there is a great deal of evidence that our investment, both governmental and private, or you want to say our private and government foreign aid, since World War II, has prevented economic development in the underdeveloped countries. Now, is it in the national interest of the United States to engage in that kind of intervention? I can't see it. I fear that a nation that tries to run the world intervening everywhere, even trying to run around doing good everywhere, winds up with a couple of million troops in South Vietnam. And I'm not sure that's in the national interest. Let me make some concluding observations, sort of. It seems to me that it is not in the national interest that the United States become deeply enmeshed in the internal political or economic affairs of other nations. It is not in the national interest either that we pour money down rat holes. If neither of those things is in the national interest, is foreign aid in the interest of the United States? It is probably in the national interest that the United States avoid the hatred and the risk that is incurred by the meddlesome benefactor. These things I'm going to mention now, I'm not sure they're all consistent. It probably is in the national interest that the United States promote political stability in our world. It probably is in our national interest to promote responsible, rational governance. And thus it would seem to me that it might be in the national interest for us to provide some aid in satisfaction of the more urgent popular expectations of the underdeveloped countries without arousing extravagant expectations. It's very, very dangerous. Some people have called the revolution since in the underdeveloped countries since World War II the revolution of rising expectations. It is very, very dangerous to arouse more hope than you are capable of satisfying. And I think, too, it is in the national interest, at least in the long run national interest, for the United States to alleviate the extremes of human suffering. But while this leaves scope for some programs of foreign aid, they have to be devised very, very carefully, coldly, rationally. And I think they require several shifts in popular attitude. That brings me to you. There are certain notions now that I wish we would change. Like, I wish we would accept the fact that the socialism or the capitalism of a country, a given country, is of little interest to us. I think we're all hung up on this. We look at governments and say, are they communist, are they socialist, are they capitalist? We think that if they're capitalist, that's good, and if they're
socialist, that's bad, and I don't see it. We ought to recognize, too, that Asia, Africa, and Latin America are not much interested in Jeffersonian democracy. And the philosophy of John Locke is largely irrelevant to their situation. That's why I get upset when I hear someone saying that we're fighting in South Vietnam to preserve freedom and democracy. The freedom and democracy that we Americans believe is worth preserving is something that I do not believe the South Vietnamese appreciate at all. And that's no condemnation of them. We got to get over the notion that we have, I think we have an admirable system of government, and we certainly have a productive economy. But that doesn't mean it's exportable everywhere. It doesn't mean that everybody else ought to want it. It's certainly true that everybody else does not want it. I think we also have to recognize that government-to-government aid is always dangerous. And private investment will be less dangerous as private investment takes place more on its own, you know, without the flag right behind it. Will private investment take place if the flag doesn't come right behind it? I don't know. Also, that trade is better than aid, because trade involves projects of mutual advantage. It's tit for tat. Nobody gets obligated to anybody. Trade leaves somebody free. When you go to the butcher and say, please, dear butcher, will you give me a pound of hamburger? You become obligated. Then you have to be very careful. And you have to, and if he starts telling you about his religion and his politics, you better agree. On the other hand, if you go in and you say, I'll take that pound of hamburger, and he gets surly or he voices his stupid political and religious opinions upon you, you just walk out and go to another butcher. And that's kind of the way I think the world ought to be organized. There is far more scope than we realize for trade, for relationships of mutual advantage between the United States and the underdeveloped countries. Far more scope than we realize. Okay, five final notes it says here. Massive infusions of aid, as you probably have heard, are not a cure-all. In fact, they can even anesthetize the patient, leading to death. There's a certain rate at which countries seem capable of absorbing capital, and to exceed this rate is not going to do any good at all. It may, in fact, promote a kind of temporary development that chokes off later development. For example, let me just use one rather extreme example. Many Christians, in fact, say, well, the least we can do is give these countries food. Because, you know, deal thy bread to the hungry. We must beware of this. When we give food to a country, we bring down the price of food in that country. You say, that's good. Yes, that's good for the consumer. But it's bad for the consumer in the long run because it's bad for the producer. American food grants to countries provide disincentives to domestic producers. We have done considerable damage to agriculture in these countries by our Christian gifts of food. That's a terrible thing to accept. You know, people say, but Jesus didn't say, deal thy bread to the hungry unless it depresses the supply price. But I just can't see it. I think Jesus also meant deal thy bread to the hungry in the long run. Don't foul up his economic development just because you want to be self-righteous. And then the last note here. This is a hornet's nest. The development of any Asian, African, Latin American economy towards self-sustaining growth is going to require revolutions. Technological revolutions, of course. But these won't occur without cultural revolutions. And these presuppose social revolutions. Or maybe it's the causal order is the other way, I don't know. But we must expect, amid all these revolutions, political revolutions. the foreign policy of the United States should not be to stop these revolutions or even to guide them, but only to push them marginally, just at the edges, toward harmony with our interests. Now, that sounds like a very, very limited foreign policy, but it gives the State Department plenty to do. In other words, if I may use one example, when Castro went Marxist-Leninist, well, there was that was a revolution. And Castro was predicting more revolution. It started out just a nice political revolution. Batista, he was a dictator. And Fidel, he was a Jeffersonian Democrat. And then we found out that stinker was a Marxist-Leninist. And we got all upset. And then he started to prove it, too. He began confiscating property and organizing communes and talking about socialist solidarity and making speeches in favor of the Soviet Union and more recently in favor of China. And that makes him a bad, bad guy. You know, and it seems to me that there is only one thing that Fidel Castro has done that really was not in our interest, substantially contrary to our interest, and that was put those missiles up. And we got those out fairly easily. And I doubt if Castro would have put those missiles in if we hadn't gotten so anxiety-ridden when he went revolutionary. Let Cuba go revolutionary. Let any country in Latin America, Asia, Africa, what have you, go revolutionary. Let them join China. Let them join Russia. Russia doesn't want most of them anymore. And China doesn't realize yet that it doesn't want most of them. And we think that somehow that when all these countries go communist, you know, let's buy the domino theory. Let's suppose that if we pull out of Vietnam next, Laos, and then Cambodia, and then Thailand, then Burma, then India. What difference does it make to the United States? You say, well, they won't have freedom and democracy. They don't have freedom and democracy now. And if they don't want it, they shouldn't have it. You say, but then they will be part of the worldwide communist conspiracy. We grossly exaggerate the extent to which there is a worldwide conspiracy. I mean, in the sense that they're all working in harmony. And moreover, as you get a larger and larger alliance, it becomes harder and harder to hold together. Look at NATO. as countries become stronger, because they can't threaten us until they become strong. As soon as they become strong, they develop their own interests and start protecting them. Look at Romania, sitting right down there in the underbelly of the Soviet Union. And Romania hasn't been very progressive economically, but politically, it's decided to carve its own role. You know, and it plays footsie with Albania and China and France and thumbs its nose at the Soviet Union. The Soviet Union can't do anything about it. If China really does, you know, assume the leadership of vast portions of Asia, Africa, and Latin America, China's going to get the same kind of indigestion that the United States got when it tried to assume this sort of leadership. Relax. Let the commies get fat. It will give them arteriosclerosis like we got. Well, yeah.
Well, isn't it true, though, when the communists come in, they dispatch thousands of people? I think that for example, when Hanoi and North Vietnam were controlling South Vietnam, they killed 75,000 people. And if they come back into power, isn't it true that several hundred thousand people will be just dispatched? I think the ruthlessness of the situation, as far as the communists taking over, is a factor. I think Tibet is a good example of complete subjugation of the people. You know, and the slaughter and the inhumane treatment and all of this, isn't this a big part of what we're fighting?
Suppose that everything you say is true. What is that to us?
Well, I think it's on our conscience, isn't it?
Why isn't the starvation of millions of people on our conscience?
Well, I think it is.
Why isn't the shooting of so many people on our conscience, the bombing of Bombay.
In this connection, would you care to say anything about Biafra if you like that?
Well, I say in general, the United States has to say, not involved. That's a hard doctrine.
We don't seem to have much conscience over the people we kill in our own country.
Well, he doesn't have a right to kill the other guy who's coming over the hill, though. Yeah, I mean, you know, almost, what percentage of the accident, highway accidents involve, the fatal highway accidents involve drinking?
60%.
60? Leo? I bet Leo would say it's higher. Is it just?
It's 60 or
70. 60 or 70%.
Same with the private airplane crash.
Yeah. Now, this is there's one part of the thing in Vietnam that I think we do have to be concerned about. We have to be careful that, after all, some of these people are going to get slaughtered because they counted on us, you know, and they identified themselves with America. And I think we should withdraw in a way that tries to give them maximum protection or chance to get out or something. There is a scheme that has been devised now that takes this into account. Clark Clifford's recent article in Foreign Affairs, his proposal for staged withdrawal from Vietnam, I think handles this reasonably well. But I really believe that excessive American concern for the ruthlessness of the communists once they come into power leads us into a lot of blunders in foreign policy. And I take the same attitude toward Rhodesia. None of our business. I do not believe in economic sanctions against Northern Rhodesia or the Union of South Africa. These issues are complicated, and we are not God.
Any economic sanctions, private economic sanctions?
Oh, you can not eat South African lobster all you don't want to eat them. I mean, that's up to you. I'm talking about the government. Organized sanctions.
Paul, what about mission fields? Is this a sort of foreign aid researches, and aren't we maybe, I was thinking here, maybe education and technology is the answer instead of out showing how to produce more land. Probably maybe difficulties or outright grants with food.
Yeah, this is much better than, if we want to help countries agriculture, it's much better. It's worse to send them food. It's best to send them stuff that is self-reproducing. I mean, like knowledge and maybe fertilizer and perhaps machinery. On education, you raised the question of education. I think we could do a lot for education in these countries, but we must do it at their invitation and in accord with their plans. That we are reluctant to do.
Well, how about our mission fields? Aren't we putting some of our beliefs on them, forcing, or I don't think an American can go over there possibly without doing somewhat taking our beliefs besides the Christianity beliefs that they're trying to give to these people. They establish schools, they establish hospitals, and so forth. Now, is this possibly wrong in your way of thinking,
too? No. This is something that, and I'm looking at it now from the standpoint of somebody who's talking about economic development and international order. I'm not talking about the spread of the church or the proclamation of the gospel or anything. Here I would say that the government will make a decision. If the government becomes hostile to the American missionaries' activities, it may throw them out, it may compel them to alter their activity or get out. And I'm willing to let the government, that government make this decision. I just do not believe that the missionaries or the church back home should appeal to the American government and say, protect us, put a little pressure on that and again.
And hasn't the missionary field in a smaller scale suffered somewhat the same reverse as the problems that our government, the government said? We've had more proven nation suffering from intervention of governments. Our missionary field at different times has suffered from the same intervention in countries, hasn't it?
I think so. I'm not made any study. You know, I got two worlds here. I learned about missions and church, and I learned about.
Well, I haven't either. I mean, other than yeah. I mean, I'm not expert.
I'm sure we have.
But, just on his point that even the missionary field is limited and as good as individuals seem to think it is, has the same problem, maybe on a smaller scale. They also being.
We build schools and hospitals in underdeveloped countries, aren't we then upsetting the local economy? Because if we cease building schools and hospitals, why they won't take over the lack of supply, same as with food, is a form of food, is it not?
Well, except that it's self-reproducing in a way.
See, I've never seen hospitals reproduce themselves.
Well, right, the hospitals aren't. But the hospitals, on the other hand, are a relatively permanent form of capital. But the schools are capital.
Knowledge itself.
Rather than consumer goods, yeah.
Rather than build the schools abroad.
And I think
part the scholar.
Pardon?
Rather than to build the schools abroad, would it be better to enforce the scholars at first?
No.
You can't impart them on an elementary level.
We do too many things to them, too. There are too many scholars who are imported and can't stand to go back home. And if they're forced to go back home, they become alienated.
There's one guy
who said, I just can't go home. There are no pinball machines back home. He had just become hooked on these pinball machines. They're playing those power flippers. I've got to quit and go cut carrots, and it's time for Henning. But I have sounded very much as if, you know, forget it. There's nothing you can do. Don't worry about those poor people starving to death. And I think we do have to obtain an attitude of withdrawal first for ourselves so that we can see more clearly what's happening and the consequences of our actions and what kind of a world it is in which we feel compelled to act. But I do believe that over the years there is a form of foreign aid that can do a great deal and that maybe a lot of American people can contribute. And that will be the granting on a rather private and personal basis of aid to countries that request it in the specific forms that they request it. And that will mean under their control doing what they say. And I think that there are a lot of Americans, especially as I see our young people today, you know, so filled with idealism, who will be willing to give a sizable chunk of their lives to teaching in these countries, or being mechanics, providing 0.4 technical assistance. I think there will be scope for this through private individuals, semi-public organizations, foundations, maybe even private businesses. But what we are going to have to accept is that if it is to do any real good, if it is not to create a more disorderly and warlike world, I think it will have to be under at the invitation of and continuously under the control of the underdeveloped countries themselves. That means the white man is going to take his orders from the black man. If we're not willing to do that, stay home. Much harm has been done by meddlesome do-gooders.
I'd just like to say one word. The food problem still bothers me. I just I've always argued with you on this point. There must be some way of when we are throwing food away and destroying it. It seems to me that this is an indication from God or from somebody that we need to be doing something. These people are crying for food over that. There must be some way of doing without hurting the economy. Let the people that run the economy. Use it to bolster up their economy. I don't know. I'm not an economist.
Right. There is something we do.
To me, there would be some way of getting this food.
No, not the food. Not the food. No, I just reject.
Why not? That's what they need. They don't make any paper.
I know, but they're going to, but you think it's terribly important to feed them this year, and you're saying, in effect, I don't care about the consequences next year and the year after that. There are alternatives. Once again, Foreign Affairs in January or April, I believe it was, had an interesting article, a good summary of the so-called Green Revolution. Leo would know more about this than I do, much more. And I don't know, maybe he may say something about it. When you talk about population. But you know, there are now hybrids that have been developed that will apparently allow almost all of these countries to grow enough food, basic kinds of foods, to feed their populations. However, these things require irrigation, a great deal of special knowledge, and all kinds of things. I invite you to look up the article in Foreign Affairs. I think it's titled The Green Revolution. And notice the number of things that must accompany this. You can't just, you know, go in there and drop those hybrid seeds in the ground. There are all kinds of things that can go wrong if you try to do it that way. And it turns out, as you look more closely into it, that a social, cultural, political revolution is going to have to accompany the use of hybrid seeds. Now, I think the United States can aid this revolution. That is, in my view, the best thing that we can do currently to deal our bread to the hungry.
Never do both.
Well, all right.
I mean,
it's my father, and I have to respect my father.
Cut out carrots. If you didn't cut these carrots, then think what terrible suffering would be caused here.
All right. Yeah. Well, but I get the last word, even though you are my father. And maybe it's like maybe it's like giving somebody who's dying of thirst the glass of salt water that he asks for. Do you do that? Well,
that's words, I think.
Maybe, Paul, it's a short time now to your father. Let's say the situation in Rhodesia or somewhere in Biafra.
Well, there are certainly some situations where the giving of food is all right. I'm warning that in too many situations, it does more harm than good to give them food. Emergency, if there's a sudden flood, it is justifiable. But we must be very, very careful. And one other thing, we could minimize some of the harm that we do if we allowed this food to flow through regular commercial channels. We're unwilling to do that, you know, because that leads to speculation and profiteering, we say. And we've got a whole set of prejudices against that. See, if we could distribute the food if we weren't so morally squeamish. We could distribute the food in a way that sort of nourished the supply channels.
Well, I
got to go cut carrots. I hope they're all cut.